The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Gary Kramer. I'm a freelance writer for Salon, the Philadelphia Gay News, and other publications. I am pleased to introduce tonight's guests, both of whom are Man Booker Prize winners. Alan Hollinghurst writes in the style of Henry James, where his characters say one thing but really mean the opposite. He deftly chronicles the manners and mores of the times, something he did in his Booker Prize-winning novel, The Line of Beauty. Hollinghurst is also interested in appearances and what's behind them. In his lush new novel, The Sparsholt Affair, it opens in the 1940s at Oxford, where three male students each become enamored with a handsome new man, a freshman that is, David Sparsholt. David is first seen by the four characters by oogling him, exercising in a gleaming singlet. He's a blank that other characters project their desires and fantasies. As readers, you will do the same, I'm sure. As the novel progresses, Hollinghurst jumps through the decades, mostly following David's gay son, Johnny, as an adolescent at first, and then as a young man in the 1970s London, and through his life to when he becomes 60 years old. The title incident, a scandal that unfolds almost entirely off page, has ramifications for both the decriminalization of homosexuality and Johnny's place in the world. The Sparsholt Affair is a seductive and spellbinding novel, as seductive and spellbinding as any of Hollinghurst's books. Like all of his novels, it contains intergenerational gay romance. But significantly, the new work also features a father-son relationship, which is literary kryptonite for me. I appreciate how the author depicts the way the younger generation learns from and enjoys the freedoms won by the older generation. What I appreciate most about Hollinghurst's novel is the narrative structure that shares with tonight's other guest, Peter Carey. Both authors prompt readers to recalibrate time, characters, knowledge, and events. These are master storytellers giving glimpses into lives that are deliberately and slowly revealed. I was first introduced to the work of Peter Carey after seeing the film Bliss, which was based on his book of the same name. It concerned a man who dies and goes to hell, but nothing really changes. Carey's other novels, Arthur and Lucinda, and The True History of the Kelly Gang, both won the Booker Prize. He's the first Australian author to win this prestigious award twice. And he might get a hat trick if the committee honors A Long Way Home, Carey's latest novel. The story introduces readers to the feisty, ingratiating Irene Bobbs and her husband Titch, a car salesman. They enter the Redux trial, a race described as 200 lunatics circumnavigating 10,000 miles of outback road. It's less a race and more a grueling test of machinery and persistence. Their navigator is their neighbor, Willie Bakuber, a spirited ex-teacher and former quiz show contestant who co-narrates the book, alternating chapters with Irene. A Long Way From Home features colorful characters, vivid imagery, and exacting language that are hallmarks of Carey's work. The race itself soon segues into a story about a race of a different kind, as Irene happens upon the skull of an Aboriginal on the Redux trial circuit. This discovery prompts Willie to investigate the world of half-castes, and as the book goes deep into Quambie Downs in Queensland, Willie enters an Aboriginal community with caves as classroom and characters like Dr. Battery talking about Langajilla. A Long Way From Home takes readers on an unexpected but not unrewarding journey. Carey's ideas about home and belonging, and that we're all foreigners, resonate. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Alan Hollinghurst and Peter Carey.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's a real pleasure to be standing behind this lectern for now the third time. And I'm very grateful for the warm welcome in Philadelphia. I'm going to read a couple of extracts from this novel. One part of a scene which Gary's already touched on in the in his introduction. Oxford, 1940. A very strange and little written about period in the university's life. Quite the opposite of the conventional Brideshead type view of Oxford as a languid extent of 3 or 4 years. Now students, the few who are still coming up, they know they're only going to be there for 1 year. They'll do a short degree, and beyond that will be the uncertainty of military service. A blackout prevails between dusk and dawn, giving ample cover for the sort of things that I seem to like to write about. And this is the first week of the autumn term, October. A little meeting has taken place of a literary club which exists to invite famous writers to come and read to them. And this whole story is narrated, this first part of the book, by someone called Freddie Green. He's written it up a long time afterwards, and this is in his rooms. You'll meet someone called Evert Dax, who is the son of a famous novelist they've just decided to invite, rather to Evert's alarm. And Peter Coyle, who is a rather camp, extravagant painter. He's a student at the Slade School in London, which has been evacuated to Oxford, along with many other things, for the duration of the war, and is very much missing London and all the mischief that he could be enjoying in the Blitz, which is raging there at the same time. You'll hear of someone called Charlie, who's not particularly important. I think that's all I need to tell you. They've had their little meeting, and Evert and Peter are looking out of the window across the quad. Peter says, "Freddie, have you seen this man?" "Who is it?" I went across. "Oh, the exhibitionist, I suppose you mean," I said. "No, he's gone," said Peter, still staring out. I stood at his shoulder and stared too. It was that brief time between sunset and the blackout when you could see into other people's rooms. Tall panes, which had reflected the sky all day, now glowed companionably here and there, and figures were revealed at work or moving around behind the lit grid of the sashes. In the set directly opposite, old Sangster, the blind French don, was giving a tutorial to a young man so supine that he might have been asleep. And on the floor above, beneath the dark horizontal of the cornice and the broad pediment, a single window was alight, a lamp on the desk projecting a brilliant arc across the wall and ceiling. "I spotted him the other day," I said. "He must be one of the new men." Peter waited with pretended patience, and Evert, frowning still, came back and looked out as well. Now a rhythmical shadow had started to leap and shrink across the distant ceiling. "Oh yes, him," Evert said, as the source of the shadow moved slowly into view, a figure in a gleaming singlet, steadily lifting and lowering a pair of hand weights. He did so with concentration, though with no apparent effort, but of course it was hard to tell at this distance, from which he showed in his square of light as massive and abstracted as if shaped from light himself. Peter put his hand on my arm. "My dear," he said, "I seem to have found my new model." At which Evert made a little gasp and looked at him furiously for a second. "Well, you better get a move on," I said, since these days new men left as quickly and unnoticed as they came. "Even you must admire that glorious head, like a Roman gladiator, Freddie," said Peter, "and those powerful shoulders. Do you see the blue veins standing in the upper arm?" "Not without my telescope," I said. I went to fill the kettle from the tap on the landing and found Jill Darrow coming up the stairs. She was late for the meeting of the club, at which she might have liked to vote herself. I was very glad to see her, but the atmosphere, which had taken on a hint of deviancy, rather changed when she came into the room. She hadn't had the benefit of 10 years in a boys' boarding school with all its ingrained depravities. I doubt she'd ever seen a naked man. Charlie said, "Ah, Darrow," and half stood up, then dropped back into his chair with an informality that might or might not have been flattering. "We want Dax to ask his father," he said, as she removed her coat and took in who was there. I set about making the tea. "Oh, I see," said Jill. There was a natural uncertainty in Evert's presence as to what could be said about his father. At the window, Evert himself seemed not to know she had come in. He and Peter stood staring up at the room opposite. Their backs were expressive, Peter smaller, hair thick and temperamental, in the patched tweed jacket which always gave off dim chemical odours of the studio. Evert neat and hesitant, a strictly raised boy in an unusually good suit, who seemed to gaze at pleasure as at the far bank of a river. "What are you two staring at?" Jill said. "Oh, you mustn't look," said Peter, turning and grinning at her, at which she went straight to the window, myself close behind. The gladiator was still in view, though now with his back turned and doing something with a piece of rope. I was almost relieved to see that the scouts had started their rounds. These are the college servants. At one window, and then the next, a small, black-coated figure appeared, reached up to close the shutters, and removed all sign of life. Across the way, the scout came into Sangster's room, half hidden by the oblong screen he carried through into the bedroom, and after a minute reappeared, edged round the two occupants, and kneeling on the window seat, gazed out for a curious few seconds before pulling the tall shutters to. By dinner time, the great stone buildings would be lightless as ruins. "Ah, Phil," said Charlie. Behind us, my own scout had come in to do the same for us. I said sternly, "Do you know who this fellow is, Phil?" Phil had fought at the Battle of Loos, and after that earlier war had spent 15 years in the Oxford police. He was affable and devoted to the college, but seemed sometimes to regret that he'd ended up in an apron, dusting and washing dishes for young men he was powerless to discipline. "What was it, sir?" He propped his screen against the wall and came over eagerly, as if I'd spotted a miscreant. I noticed now that our own reflections were hanging very faintly between us and the view of other windows. I pointed upwards. "This ridiculous fellow," I said. "Oh, him, sir," said Phil, a bit disappointed, but trying for a moment to share our own interest in the luminous figure. "I happen to know there was a bit of trouble there." "What sort of trouble?" said Peter. "Well, the noise, sir. Dr. Sangster's been complaining about it." "Oh," said Evert, "noise?" "Rhythmical creaking, apparently, sir," said Phil, with a grim look. "Oh, goodness," said Evert. "He's not one of ours, though, in fact," said Phil. "Ah," I said. "No, he's one of the Brazenose men," said Phil. In the vast, gloomy college, its staircases half deserted since the start of the war, new members of requisitioned colleges had been slipped in here and there, disoriented freshmen who found themselves also evacuees. Brazenose had been seized on by a ministry of some kind, who, according to my tutor, were rather unsure what to do with it. "If you could just excuse me, Mr. Green." "Oh, of course, Phil." "You don't happen to know his name?" said Jill. "He's called Sparsholt, miss," said Phil, with a small cough, as he swung the shutters to and dropped the iron bar safely in its slot. "Sparsholt," said Peter, weighing the word and smiling slyly at Evert. "Sounds like part of an engine or a gun." Phil looked at him blankly for a second or two. "I dare say you're right, sir," he said, and went through into the bedroom. I set out my best Meissen cups, which I hoped might please Jill, and in the new closeness of the panelled and shuttered room, we settled down to have tea. Well, that's the first sighting of the figure David Sparsholt, who will, in a way, be at the centre of this book, and in a way, won't. It's a hard book to talk about without giving away a lot of the what I hope will come as surprises to the reader, with the jumps between its five sections, when often quite a long period of time is missed out. And the reader, at the beginning of each new section, I hope will take a page or two to reorient themselves and find out where they are and when they are. So I'm going to jump ahead into the middle of the five sections. This is set in 1974. And just introduce you to David Sparsholt's son, Johnny, now 22, who becomes, as Gary was saying, really the protagonist of the novel. He's gay. He's been to a rather progressive art college. He's come to London. He's working for a picture restorer. He's looking for a boyfriend. He's fallen in with someone called Ivan, whom he's very keen on, but Ivan is oddly elusive and keeps slipping out of his grasp just when he thinks he's got him. they were going to go to a gay club together, which Johnny had never been to one before, but for complicated reasons it didn't happen. And he's now going to one with a young lesbian couple that he's met, Francesca, who's very grand and has only once in her life been known to take public transport, and her large, almost silent friend, Una, who works in the cosmetics department at Phoenix, a department store in Bond Street. And they have supper beforehand in a Chinese restaurant in Soho. "So how are we getting there?" Johnny said when they were outside. He wasn't going to risk the bus again. "Taxi," said Una. "Or we could take the underground." He saw his funds for the evening running awkwardly thin. "It's probably quicker." "Oh, the underground." Francesca stood in apparent indecision, gazing at a spot a few yards away on the pavement, beneath which she seemed to picture it running. "Is it still open?" Johnny looked at his watch. It was 10 past 10. "Well, yes," he said. And he saw in a moment the tube as perhaps she imagined it, rather than as he knew it from frequent use. A deep, proletarian labyrinth, a sort of human sewer rumoured to underlie the whole city. "Oh, but look." And she ran a few steps into the road and somehow caught the eye of a taxi driver passing the end of the street, who backed up and turned and in 20 seconds was taking her instructions through the open window. In the cab, as it swept round Trafalgar Square and out into Pall Mall, Johnny had the uncomfortable but elated feeling that his London life had taken off. Not how he'd imagined it, but the unimagined, when it happened, had the bite of authenticity. The women travelled side by side, and Johnny sat on the folding seat, looking at them and past them, at the vanishing road and the lights of other vehicles surging up or dropping behind. He still felt hungry. He'd only had one thing at the little Chinese, and then the bill was split three ways, and he couldn't protest. He ate almost in the kitchen there, with the poor splayed roasted ducks hanging just above your head like lanterns. He pushed down the window an inch, but the throb of the engine shivered it shut in 2 or 3 seconds. Racing backwards to his first gay club, he felt a little queasy. "This is it," Francesca shouted to the driver, and they stopped at a narrow white building on the Earl's Court Road. A small queue had formed outside, and there was a certain defiance in showing so plainly where they were going. The cabbie looked out warily. "You don't want to go in there, love," he said to Una. "It's a puff's place." "Yes, we do," said Una. Francesca paid him and took the change in full and flapped her hand in front of her face when he drove off in a loud fart of diesel fumes. Ivan was coming down the other way from the tube station, his duffel coat unbuttoned and the long fringe of his woolen scarf bobbing like a sporran between his thighs. "Darling," said Francesca, so that Johnny didn't know where he was after all the cruel things she said about him earlier. They went into a narrow space inside the door, music audible now, swing doors beyond like a cinema, and a glimpse when they opened of the bare room at the start of a party. The large man in a bomber jacket glanced sceptically at the girls. "You know this is a gay club," he said. "We've been here thousands of times," said Francesca, looking wanly past him. "So you're lesbians, are you?" "Don't be vulgar," said Francesca. "So how are you going to prove it?" said the man. Francesca sighed and looked away as if dealing with this kind of person were a quite new indignity. Then Una, with a hint of a smile on her large, flawless face, pulled her towards her and with a tilt of the head started kissing her with a steady pushing and chewing motion which Francesca, while taking no active part, made no effort to prevent. Johnny giggled in amazement and felt a sudden knot of excitement that he and Ivan might be made to do the same thing. "Whoa, whoa," said the bouncer, but it took him another 10 seconds to separate them. He looked Johnny and Ivan up and down. "Right you are, gentlemen," he said, and unhitched the rope for them all. It turned out you had to be a member. Francesca claimed she was, but this time couldn't prove it, so they all had to sign a list and give their address, which made Johnny uneasy. He imagined them getting in touch with his aunt, with whom he was living at the time, and he put a different number in the street. It cost 50p each. "And of course you get your meal," said the little Irish boy in the cubbyhole. "Then it was 10p to leave your coat." "Shall we put ours together?" said Johnny. "Save money." But Ivan said, "No, it's okay." So they go into the club, Johnny sort of gets his bearings, they have a drink, he then goes off to the bar to fetch them all another drink. And this is a scene which reflects the curious conditions afflicting nightlife, and I think perhaps particularly gay nightlife, and that this is 7 years after the Sexual Offences Act of 1967, but the prevailing conditions are rather different, as the novel shows you, from what they are now. When Johnny got back to the table, a fat, middle-aged man with a tray was hovering there. "It's your salads," he said, and started to unload little bowls among the bottles and glasses. "Oh, God," said Francesca. "I'm not hungry," said Ivan. "It's all free. Comes with your membership," said the man, smiling firmly. "We've already eaten," said Francesca. "It's just your salads," he said, as if a salad were a medicine, and with the air of someone used to resistance for all his pleasantness. "You've got to have them." He put down four forks wrapped in paper napkins. Johnny peered into the bowls, which each contained a bit of iceberg lettuce, a ring of tomato, and, almost hidden, unnameable, a glistening square of meat. He sat down when the man moved on to the next table and unwrapped a fork. "I didn't know we got this," he said. "Don't eat it," said Una. "No," said Johnny. "It's the licensing law," said Ivan. "They have to serve a meal." This seemed to Johnny both absurd and quite fortunate. He was more hungry now than he'd been before dinner, and food was here, the shameful stopgap of the boozing student. "Well, it doesn't look too bad." And with the others gazing at him, and then thinking it better to resume their conversation, he ate his lettuce and tomato, there was no dressing on it, and popped in the pink-grey, tongue-sized piece of meat, which he chewed uncertainly, thinking it was probably ham, pre-packed, sweaty, and with a knot of gristle in it that he had to bring out behind his hand and hide in the bowl under his screwed-up napkin. It was dismaying and connected in a momentary violence of image with the glazed, squashed ducks earlier. Sometimes meat disgusted him. He took a swig from his cold beer bottle. Ivan raised an eyebrow into his fringe and gestured to his own bowl. "Have mine," he said. "No, thanks," said Johnny. "Well, actually," and switching the two bowls, he ate Ivan's salad too. It only took a minute, smiling defiantly as he chewed and thought of other things of Ivan's that he'd like. And when that was done, the thing with the force now of some future anecdote, he pulled Una's salad towards him and polished it off. He rested. He felt some natural deference as he looked at Francesca. Then he smirked and she said, "What? Oh, go on," waving her hand over the bowl as she turned her head in mingled amusement and disgust. Thank you very much.
I know how to do this in 45 minutes, and I know how to do it in 5 minutes, but this is 20 minutes, and this is I'm starting it now for 20 minutes. So when it rings, I'll stop. I didn't come from a very literary household, but I do remember one of the thrills of my childhood was going on vacation with my father, who never read anything, and to find that he also wanted to read. Alan will, I'm sure, know what these books are, about a pilot called Biggles, which I loved. And my father, on holiday, whether he's drunk or something, bought five of them. And so we feasted on Biggles books. And the things that I remember about this particularly is my father couldn't read the book until he'd gone to the very end and seen how everything ended up. And I was thinking about that, particularly in relationship to this book, of course, because it ends in a very strange place that not only my father, but maybe many of you will not expect when you begin the book. My father may well have recognised the character of Titch, who bears some relationship to the circumstances of my father's life, but not to his character. The character of Titch is married to a woman called Irene, and she is one of the narrators of this book. And I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning. And in this way, writers destroy everything they've written. Because, of course, my voice is not Irene's voice, for which I apologize. For a girl to defeat one father is a challenge, but there were two standing between me and what I wanted, which was not to fiddle faddle, a lovely little fellow called Titch Bobs. The first father was my own. When he discovered that I, his teeny Irene, his little mouse, his petite-sized mademoiselle, had all by herself proposed matrimony to a man of 5'3", he spat his Wheaties in his plate. Titch's father was number two. He came out of the gate at a gallop, 100% in favour. I was a beauty, a bobby dazzler, until in the hallway by the coat stand, he gave me cause to slap his face. My sister was older and, as they say, more experienced. She could not see why I would want so small a husband. Did I plan to breed a team of mice? Ha, bloody ha. Beverly was 5'2½" and always breaking off engagements to lanky Lurch or gigantic Dino, or the famous football player whose name I'm not ignorant enough to mention. I would have been afraid to shake his hand. Forget the other business. Beverly made her bed and got what you might expect, i.e. 30-hour labours and heads as big as pumpkins. My own children were as tiny and perfect as their daddy, ideal in their proportions, in the lovely coordination of their limbs, in the pink, apply cheeks they inherited from Titch, the smile they got from me. My sister could not abide my happiness. She would spend years looking for evidence that it was somehow false. When her first husband ran away to New Zealand, she wrote me a spiteful letter saying I was more interested in my husband than my children. She said her children were everything to her. She knew, she wrote, I only married Titch because of the money I would get from him. She was upset, of course. Why wouldn't she be? She'd married a bastard. And now she was divorced, she claimed, without a penny. So could she please go and live in the childhood home we had both inherited and whose sale she had always managed to impede? Could Titch and I have used the money? She didn't ask. Would it have changed our lives? Of course. I agreed on a peppercorn rent and kept my feelings to myself. Beverly liked to say that I was willful, which was an idea she got from Mum. But Mum liked me being willful. She got a real kick from seeing how I got my way. Of course, she was a bit the same, Mum. And she was blessed with such neat level teeth and cheekbones, you would do anything to see her smile, even if you had to buy a washing machine to make her do it. Sorry, I've done that thing. She got Dad to purchase the Ford, which was what brought Titch to our door in Victoria, Australia. It was Victory in Europe Day, May the 8th, 1945. No one will ever know how Mum planned to utilise the Ford, drive down to Colac and see her sister after church. Maybe, but that was one story not even Dad would swallow. Didn't matter. He went on and wrote the cheque to the salesman, Dan Bobs, who, as I discovered when I opened the front door on VE Day, had thrown in free driving lessons, which would be supplied by his sonny. Oh, Lord, what a sight that sonny was, there on our front porch with his cardboard suitcase on a Tuesday morning. I learnt he was to stay with us. And so, watching how this time issue is going along here, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit now. These are two, Titch and Irene, are two important characters. Their great passion in life is to... he's a great car salesman. They want a car dealership. They arrive in this little town of Bacchus Marsh in intent on having one. The third character who will be important in this story is next door. His name's Willie Barkhuber. He's important in the story because Titch and Irene are wonderful people and full of energy and will, and they have no interest in history at all. They know very little about where they are. They certainly don't understand that the country they're in, Australia, is really been the product of is the result of a violent invasion and racial war, which has resulted in the murder of many, many Aboriginal people and the destruction of their culture. This is probably the most important, if you want to think about what Australia is, this is the most significant thing about Australia, and it's the hardest thing for anybody to deal with. And they're dealing with it in the way we all dealt with it in the 50s in Australia, by sort of not knowing about it or deciding not to know about it. And this is, in the end, you want to talk about what a book is about. This is what this book is about. But things have to happen for these people to learn about their history. And one of the things that's going to happen to them is Willie Barkhuber, their next-door neighbour, who happens to be there waiting for something wonderful to happen in his life. He comes from many disasters. He's a rather romantic, melancholy sort of chap who's just been fired from his job as a school teacher for hanging a student at the second floor window of the Bacchus Marsh High School. I hope when you read it you will feel great sympathy for Willie Barkhuber and understand why he did this ridiculous thing at this moment, and you'll understand why he's unemployed. You'll also know that he's an essential part of the story because he actually does read. He's curious about history. He's obsessed with maps. And he's going to be important because he's going to end up being the navigator in this great car race which the husband and wife with the car dealership are going to go into, and they need a navigator. Anyway, this is just the moment when Willie looks over his fence and looks at the great shed that has been waiting there for someone to occupy it, and sees the arrival, finally, of his new neighbours. I turned to the former panel beater's open-sided shed, a pavilion, really, stretched across the back of the property. There, wrapped in shadow, was the vehicle, a two-tone Ford Custom Line. Of course, I didn't know the brand quite yet, but it was so new and shiny that it contained an entire sky, towering white cumulus in its bulbous fenders. I could hear the voices of a man and woman, also the song of cooling metal. "Hang on," the woman said. "No, no, the other," said the man. They might have been doing the dishes, she washing, he drying at the kitchen sink. I was drawn inevitably towards the automobile. I called first "good morning" and then "cooey." Then I was inside the shed, which had become the home of pigeons with alarming wings. Then came another awful noise, like a filing cabinet dragged across a concrete floor. And there they were, shooting out from under the Ford, the astonishing pair clad in faded overalls, lying flat on mechanics' trolleys, icons with bright silver spanners in their hands. Mister must have been 5'2". And she even smaller. Mrs.'s hair was so tousled and curling, she might have been, had not all the other evidence been so much to the contrary, a boy. Her husband's complexion was smooth and glowing. He could have been a girl. Yet to talk of boys and girls is to miss the point. The new arrival stared at me, and I somehow understood that they, being visions, were not required to speak. "I am Willie Barkuber," I said, for the war was less than 10 years over and it was best to get the German business finished with at once. And at this stage, a very dramatic thing happens, which is that the Apple timer, which I've so carefully put here, seems to have frozen several minutes ago, so I've got no idea what time it is. Anyway, we'll do our best, you can get the hook or whatever to drag me off the stage if I'm going too long. The young couple who are about to get a General Motors dealership to sell this car are passionate, or at least the husband is passionate, to enter this car race called the Red X Trial. And that was a real event in Australia in the 50s, which I certainly remember as a child. And it's hard now to imagine that such a thing would even exist. But I'm sure, I've been to Philadelphia for basketball from time to time. And so I know, like you know, that a town or city can go totally insane about sporting events. And the Red X Trial was sort of like that, in that you suddenly have all these people obsessed with the race. Although it's not a race, it's a reliability trial, but don't worry about that. We'll call it a race. And so, yeah, people would have come to fisticuffs in bars about which car, whether a Holden or a Ford was a better car, and what would win and what wouldn't. And finally, you know, you get 260 contestants driving cars, the sort of cars that you would, you know, take your kids to school or go shopping in or go for a Sunday drive in. And there they are setting off to circumnavigate Australia, 10,000 miles, roads really, really you could not call roads, the sort of tracks that will break a car in half. And the whole of the country is riveted by this event. And for Titch and Irene, they sort of believe that if they can do this and if they could do well in this, it will establish their business in everybody's mind. And Willie's there because... Well, Willie's there because Titch comes to visit him one night and realizes that he has all these maps everywhere and he actually does understand maps. And Lo Irene is a brilliant driver, very talented. He cannot tell her this, but she's an appalling navigator. And so Willie is conscripted in a curious way where Titch says, well, would he please take his clothes off and stand on the scales, because there is an issue of how much gasoline this is going to be consumed, and so the weight of the people in the car matter. So he's ready for something like this in his life. Now, the reason I was so interested in the Red X Trial, and the reason all of this takes place in 1954, is because that's the year. There were only three Red X Trials. 54 was one of them. And the thing that I thought, looking as a child who'd been aware of these things, looking at the YouTube videos where you can see the old newsreels, I do suggest you do look at them. They're quite amazing. And you see these cars ploughing through the territory around the top of Australia. And you know that no one in any of those cars has a clue about the deep history of the country. And that while they are involved in their maps and the strip maps for the Red X, they have no idea that there's a 50,000-year-old culture there. And that 15,000-year culture, if you wanted to map it, is crisscrossed with lines of ritual, religion, ceremony, quite practical lines. Excuse me. Just nerves, sorry. And so I suddenly thought, thinking about, when I was beginning to think about this, thinking about the Red X trial, thought, oh my God, here's a place for a book. They're going to be, we can have two sets of maps. And the way we will discover the older maps is through the white guys driving their cars around the country. A little bit, I thought, like, you know, dogs peeing around the edge of their territory. And we were a little bit like that. And I thought, that map, the map of the Red X trial, will inevitably intersect with really ancient stories. I mean, that spot by the service station is maybe where the Rainbow Serpent crossed the road in a really, really old story. So that's what I thought. And because this is really the point of the book, the intersection of the cultures, the ignorant white people, who are not all as white as they think they are, by the way, which is also a big aspect of Australian history, are going to intersect with black history and black culture. And I was a white writer who really had no choice, having had this idea, but to confront black readers with this story. And it's a sort of a scary thing to do. All my friends, my Australian friends, told me I shouldn't do it, and that would be a big mistake. And people started to talk about appropriation and various things like that. And I certainly had mixed views myself. I mean, I certainly believe that if you are a member of a race that has been invaded, and where your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents have been murdered and tortured, you're really not going to be very receptive to a member of the murdering race coming along saying, I know exactly how you felt. I'm going to write about you now. So I can understand the rage of somebody responding to that sort of thing. On the other hand, white people made this atrocious story. This would not have happened without white people. White people have to deal with that, and it was a hard thing to do. But given that you're going to have black readers, it's always good to have your black readers read you before publication and to find what's wrong with what you've done or what's offensive about what you've done, which actually, as it turned out, wasn't all that much. But and so as I get into the bit of the story where it sort of veers off, I wasn't in a scarier place as I expected to be. And I found my black readers in agreement with what I was doing. There were not hundreds of them. I didn't have focus groups, I must point out. I'm just going to read you. How are we going for time, do you think? No one has any idea. Okay. 5 minutes?
5 minutes, Peter.
Thank you so much. It's perfect. So this is the point where the story, which seems to be about white people in a car race, changes, or it begins to change for the reader. It's quite a long way in. This is a bit that my dad was not ready for, because the story veers as off. Irene, they're north of Brisbane. They're on their way to Townsville. It's tropical. It's not pretty. It's relatively harsh country. Irene has a call of nature, let's say. And she takes a little trowel, garden trowel, which they're used to taking, and she heads off into the bush beside a creek. And what she sees there is that a tree has fallen over and fallen into the creek and left a huge hole in the earth. And this is her voice. On the crater walls, only a foot from the surface, I saw the roots had grown around dead bones. The first crumbled in my hands, and I saw there were so many others. A graveyard. Sickening. That is, these were not animals. There were so many, they must be blacks. I extracted a human jawbone. I retreated. I rushed back into my overalls. I was an interfering woman. I climbed down into the excavation where I was able to lift a human skull from the broken soil. It was just a tiny thing, as fragile and powdery as an emu egg. I was a mother. I knew what it was to hold a tender child, and I knew this must be a little boy. And all these bones around him must be his family. He was quite clean and very light, and it seemed he might turn to dust if I was clumsy. So I tucked the digging tool in my back pocket and held him in both hands, and then carried him as carefully as if he were a bowl of water back through the dull shrubs and grasses. So Titch, of course, her husband, is just sort of irritated by this interruption of history and wants to get on with the race. Irene, shocked and devastated by this in a way, is determined to take it to the police in Townsville, the skull. And, of course, the police have not the slightest interest. I know it seems ludicrous to them because if there was a crime, it was committed perhaps a century ago. But the interesting thing that happens for Irene is that the police knew exactly where it came from. And this will be the beginning of many stories in the book that sort of deal with this sort of thing. And it sounds very dark and very dire, and it is in a way. But even, well, let's just say there's a lot of laughter as well. It's a laugh a second all the way to the heart of darkness. And I think the role of humor in the book, even while it's very dark, is an important one because, by God, we've got to get some light from somewhere. Anyway, I think that's 20 minutes. I apologize for this. It's not my fault. And I think we're going to sit down now. Is that right? We're going to sit down and we're going to talk with the distinguished English gentleman.
Thank you very much for those readings, and curse the Apple iPhone. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I think most of you know the way this works. Raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you.
The least shy audience I've sat in.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah.
All right. This question is mainly for Mr. Hollinghurst, though, Mr. Carey, you may answer.
You
may.
Thank you.
You may give your input. Speaking as someone who read The Stranger's Child while he was at Haverford for a class, how do you go about doing period research? How much do you do, and what exactly do you study? Very broad, open question. Give it a shot.
I'll do my best. I avoid research as much as possible, actually. I think, you know, you don't want there to be glaring errors which are going to spoil the authenticity of the thing for particularly for people who know about the period. But I think research has a horrible way of shrieking research at you when you see it in a work of fiction. I've read too many historical novels in which every object that's encountered is, you know, described a great deal of what it was made of, where it came from, and everything. Research itself now has become so incredibly easy, you know, and you just go, and there it is. I always feel that if writing something in period, I want to immerse myself in the period in one way or another, and then almost to sort of forget it, and to write about periods in the past as sort of naturally as if they were now. It is interesting writing about things which go before your own lifetime, and you've done this and gone further back than I have, you know, writing about the 19th century and so on.
Yeah.
I've never gone earlier than 1913, which is to me the sort of limit of
like your birthday.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Peter.
So
that thing that Henry James calls, you know, the visitable past. I feel that there's a sort of connection of mentality. I feel I still understand how people thought and spoke at that period. Yes. But I would be nervous going back further.
Well, I like to go back to places that I'm nervous about. Mm. And I think the visitable past is a really interesting idea, which has mostly sustained me in the sense that I'm 74. So, you know, my grandparents were sort of stretched back a long time. So the living memory in the family goes back a long way. But I agree with you totally about the most important thing about research in the end. I think do a lot and immerse yourself, like you say. But in the end, what matters is the story and the characters. And the minute research starts to impede story and get in the way of everything, it's there to be got rid of. And you know, in my case, you know, I might, you know, read 200 pages to get the wisdom you'd get from half a sentence or whatever. So it's the story that's the thing, no?
I like to have sort of just a few objects which do a lot of sort of period business, you know, are, I hope, suggestive of a whole lot of other objects which I don't bother to mention. It's that thing of just wanting to get the sense of that people in the past didn't live with this, with a sense of how quaint they were going to seem to people 50 years hence. And they live, what I try to capture, if I can, is the sense of the way we all live, which was with no knowledge of the future.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Carey, your presentation seemed to me to raise the issue of the author's right to write about the other. Mm. A man writing in the guise of a woman, a white person writing in the guise of a black person in the novel. Would both of you, Mr. Hollinghurst as well, give us some thoughts that you have, go a little further on that issue, which
is... I'd love to. Thank you. Well, I do think, first of all, you know, the role of a writer is to imagine what it is to be other, I believe. And I have no interest in myself. I have an interest in, you know, imagining what it might be to someone else. So that's the first thing, and I think we should be able to do that. I certainly, the thing about this particular book is, well, two things. One is, while it does, it is, of course, about the effect of a white invasion on a black culture, one should just grasp the fact that it's a white story. And that's an important way to think about this book and what it is. But having said that, then you have to grasp the nettle, I do believe, in imagining what the effect of that on, you know, black people in Australia, Aboriginal people in Australia right now. So I believe, and while I understand that people could be hostile to that, and I would understand completely and empathise with their hostility to the notion of white people telling that story, I do believe that with care, respect, time, you can... this is what we're meant to be able to do. And if you can't write fiction, and if you don't write fiction, it seems impossible. And time and time again, one publishes a novel and finds people writing about it as if what you're doing is producing disguised biography. It isn't what I do, it isn't what we do. So if we're going to have a use, I think it is that we can make up lives, that we can inhabit other lives, and we can do it successfully in such a way that the people who are related, at least in some way, to the people whose lives are being invented, will grant the credibility, the insight, and the value of what you do. I think I can do that. And I'd say on the basis of this book and the people I talked to while I was writing the book and the response of Indigenous Australians to the book, I think I can do it. So the thing that we've got to allow is that we can do it, but we shouldn't be lazy or complacent or disrespectful or afraid. You know, when I mean disrespectful, I mean that one is not, it would be a mistake to sort of generate holy images of the victimised other, because that is what we call in Australia, the technical term is just bullshit. So, anyway, Alan.
Yeah, well, of course I agree with you. I mean, the value of any writing, particularly of fictional writing, lies in the insight, the intelligence, the wisdom, the skill, the taste, by which I mean something rather wide about what we understand to be sort of acceptable, both in sort of literary terms and ethical terms. And a bad writer, could do something very offensive with this kind of material. A great writer like Peter can fully claim that sort of imaginative right to see life from other points of view. And as you said, I mean, it's a fundamental thing of fiction. I mean, it comes into a birth. You're an
answer. What's me?
Yes, you've set it.
It's over. Time to get up, guys.
I mean, this question on Australia is a massive one.
It's a big one, but it's a big one. It's a big one here. It's a big one in Canada.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah.
And one a small anecdote, which I confess I've told before, was being at a playwrights conference in Canberra, in Australia, in the middle '80s, and an Aboriginal activist called Gary Foley, who was not a warm and cuddly man at all, addressing us, said, "Look, I know you fellas all want to help, so I'll tell you how you could help us best. Don't write about us, all right? Because we've already got enough crap to deal with, and a lot of it comes from things that you've imagined about us. And we could really, it would be better if we didn't have any more of those sorts of things." I thought he was absolutely correct. I mean, what he was talking about was a sort of a second colonization of the indigenous imagination by white people who didn't know what they were talking about. And I think that's when Alan talked about sort of, I think he said bad writers, let's just say not very good writers, in most things in life, and I'm sure it's true of dentists and carpenters, that mediocrity is probably the norm. So you can take the same, I think, to be true of literature and people, white people writing about indigenous people, mediocrity will be the norm. And so mostly what will be produced will not be satisfactory for anybody.
Wondered if you could talk about how you think about time in your storytelling, sequential time, compressed time, and gaps in time.
Well, is this particularly for Alan, I think, yeah?
Well, I was struck by your saying, the crucial thing about your new book being that the reader will end up somewhere very unexpected.
Yes.
And this is something which I must say interests me more and more as I get older. And this way of writing that I seem to have used for my last two books, of covering a large period of time in episodes with sometimes quite long gaps in between them, I love the disorienting effect of it, and I love the way that by juxtaposing two periods with their quite distinct sort of mores and atmospheres, you can sort of ironize these changes and surprises of time.
Yeah.
For me, it's something to do too with resisting a sort of classical closure and resolution in a narrative. And I love the idea that a narrative can jump forward two decades and go off in a completely unexpected angle. And this seems to me sort of more like life and less like a novel.
I'm with him. I mean, I think Alan and Time are very beautiful and very well done. I always think I sort of struggle with time in a way. Mm-hmm. So I don't really want to address it.
This is very specific. I have a hard time imagining Johnny's painting. Help me out. Who does Johnny paint like?
Who does Johnny paint like? That's another of these things which I haven't quite specified, and which I sort of invite the reader to imagine for themselves. I think he's... What I hope the reader will feel about Johnny is that he's... he's working in this rather compromised medium. Indeed, I think all the characters in the end are sort of living as most of us do, really, under sort of compromises, compromised versions of our ideals. I didn't want him to be a sort of heroic painter fighting against Philistinism, but someone who comes to a particular sort of accommodation with the system in doing this weird thing, which is a particularly weird thing to be doing now, probably, which is painting people's portraits, where obviously he hopes to satisfy himself, but it all really depends on satisfying the sitter who's paying. So I imagined him as... I mean, you've probably not had the experience of going to the annual exhibition of the Royal Society of Portrait Painters, have you? No. Well, I wouldn't make the Atlantic crossing especially for... But I mean, it's just fascinating to see these... Well, people often technically very, very gifted who are producing the strange sort of ersatz retro kind of art. Mm. So I don't think Johnny's like anyone you'd know, probably, as an artist.
Do you guys tour together, or is this like your first sort of event together, or were you
first date?
Yeah, or will you meet in other cities and do the?
We've never met before in our lives. No.
Oh, there you go.
No.
Just curious.
Yes.
Yeah, and this is it.
I think we've officially come to the end. Please join me in thanking Alan Hollinghurst and Peter Carey.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.